session number 21581, rule 3.
Run apps, rule 3.
So we had these rowing regattas, but I think it should be remembered that the German airfields were only a matter of about 10 miles away in North Norway. And so whilst we were holding our rowing regattas, at least to break the boredom of sitting almost doing nothing, because by that time we had carried out any minor repairs that were necessary, and there was really nothing more to do, we had to have the guns fully manned at all times for fear that the Germans came over and decided to have an air raid, because they came over most days. So it was a fairly hairy experience having a regatta with all the guns manned to ensure that we weren't bombed. It's we finally, after we'd been there about 3 weeks, the order went forth and we sailed back from Murmansk to Sadiesfield again.
Do you think the Russians would have been capable of helping you with repairs?
I don't think there were very many facilities at that time in Murmansk. I mean, I know now that it's the headquarters of the North Russian fleet of many, many nuclear submarines and what have you, but I think at that time they did not have the facilities at least to repair something like the Trinidad. They may have been able to send up plate from somewhere else, but they were fairly disorganized in that area. All they wanted were the supplies from us to be put on a train and sent south to the battlefield.
What are your next memories?
Oh, my next memories are coming home. I came back to Scapa Flow. I came back to the Tyne because I was by that time a very experienced watchkeeper. I was sent back to Chatham for reallocation, and I joined HMS Wayland, which was another depot ship. But a depot ship that again was going to be used for supply and the supply of and repairs for the Eastern Fleet. And we set sail from Portsmouth in, I think it was about September 1942. And we came up to, we went up to Glasgow and stayed in the Clyde for about 2 months while we were doing various ASDIC trials and one or two other things, and then we sailed to Gibraltar down the coast of Africa to South Africa to Cape Town through to Port Elizabeth or to Durban to Mombasa, where we became the fleet repair ship for the Eastern Fleet, which had come back from Singapore to Trincomalee in Ceylon. And then because Trincomalee in Ceylon was getting a bit dangerous, they based the Eastern Fleet in Mombasa in Kenya. And we became the depot ship for two flotillas of destroyers, a couple of groups of cruisers, squadrons of cruisers, and we had about four battleships out there at that time, plus aircraft carriers. So we were fairly busy in Mombasa. But then it was decided that we were important enough to be attached to the North African campaign. And so we left Mombasa and went up the coast of Africa to Aden, up the Red Sea to the canal, through the canal to Alexandria, and then Alexandria all the way along the coast, following the 8th Army and the destroyers and the landing ships that were operating in that area, to just behind Tunis, at a very large area called Ferryville, which is Lake Ferryville. And the Ferryville was the fairly large, comparable with Portsmouth Dockyard, anyhow, naval base. But it was in a shattered condition because the Germans had sabotaged it before they left, and the Americans had been over and bombed it, and so it was in a pretty deadly condition. It was just almost flattened. And we became the depot ship for the landing craft that were going to be used for Sicily, the Sicilian landings, and the Italian landings. And then, after that was completed, well, those of us who discussed it thought we would probably be coming home for the invasion, because there would be landing ships in the invasion, obviously. And so we thought, well, we're so good at our job with landing ships that we'd come home for the invasion. And of course we didn't. They said, no, you will rejoin the Eastern Fleet, which we did. But this time, of course, we went back to Trincomalee. But on this question of landing ships, one of the most interesting comments one can make about the American-type landing ship and the British-type landing ship is that the Americans produced their landing ships for a one-way-only trip. The idea was that they would either bring the landing ships over if they were large enough, they would sail them over, the big ones, the landing ship tank, but the others they brought over on ships. And these were had been produced in shipyards in America literally in 3 days. They were built in components all over the country, shipped by rail or lorry to a shipyard. Cranes put them together like a set of Meccano. They were welded up and then they were finished. And so you had a situation where if there was a pipe going down the length of the landing ship tank, that they would take the pipe up to the bulkhead. They would, with an acetylene torch, they would burn a hole in the bulkhead. Then they would weld the pipe on the bulkhead. And the other side, they would weld the pipe on the bulkhead there. In the British, we would have had a flange each side of the bulkhead, a flange on the pipe, and the two flanges, that would be four flanges altogether, bolted together. This would give you at least a sense of flexibility. But on the American ones, because they were welded to the bulkhead, both sides, as soon as you got a near miss from a bomb, and the bulkhead shivered, the pipes came loose, and you got leaks all over the place. And most of our time was spent refitting these landing craft to ensure that they would stand the vibration that one would get from either a bomb dropping or the a mine going up, or even pushing themselves up onto a beach. And the Americans thought we were completely and utterly crazy, because they said, that's all right, we'll just send for some more landing craft. And they actually did. The Americans that landed on Sicily did not use the same landing craft that they used for landing in North Africa. They just left them there as scrap for the Arabs to take to pieces, and they used some new ones for Sicily and some new ones in Italy. But we were repairing landing craft that was in perfectly good nick, except for the fact that they had sprung leaks all over the place due to the way they'd been assembled. Most intriguing. And so we finally went back to the Eastern Fleet, and we sailed from Ferryville to Alexandria. We stayed in Alexandria for 2 or 3 weeks, mainly having leave and refurbishing and refitting and resupplying, if you like, and you're getting all new supplies aboard. And we then left there and went down the canal, across the Indian Ocean to Bombay, and Bombay down to Colombo, and then Colombo into Trincomalee, where we were the depot ship for the Eastern Fleet for about just over a year, I suppose.
What was it like in Trincomalee?
It was very hot. Tropical jungle down to the beach. Very hot indeed. But a very interesting experience because we were able to go ashore, meet people. I even had a leave up in the, a fortnight's leave, up in the mountains of Ceylon, Dietilauer, which was a rest camp for the Navy. There was a rest camp for the Navy, rest camp for the Army, and a rest camp for the Air Force, each of them with cabins, swimming pool, dining halls, something like 9,500 feet up. Quite an experience in itself because down on the coast, the temperature went down to about 85 at night. And so when we went up by train from Trincomalee, and it took us 24 hours by train to go up from Trincomalee to Dietilauer, to the rest camp, we found it was gradually getting colder, and we'd been told to take our greatcoats with us. And when we finally got up to the top, of course, at 10,000 feet, 10,000 feet, oxygen was a bit low, and so we were a bit out of breath by that time. But I always remember in my cabin, I shared a cabin with another ERA, and there was mosquito nets, which I had been fairly used to seeing down in Trincomalee. But there was also a pile of four blankets alongside the bed. And I said to the boy who was helping me unpack my kit, "What are the four blankets for?" And I always remember he said, "Master, you will need those at night." And I thought, blankets? You know, I hadn't been used to blankets for about 7 or 8 months down in Trincomalee. We just slept in a pair of shorts and that was it. But it slowly but surely got colder, and I not only had those four blankets, but I had my greatcoat over me afterwards. It was freezing at night, although the temperature was probably only down to about 60. The comparison with being down on the coast was quite phenomenal. One really felt cold. But it was an excellent leave. I can remember I had photographs of all the things we did while we were up there. It was just complete relaxation.
And the work that you did there?
What, in the rest camp?
In Trincomalee?
Oh, in Trincomalee. Oh, we did all various things. I had a trip on a destroyer. Can't remember the name of it now because it was only about 2 or 3 days. And we did a fair amount of work with ships that came in from the Burma coast and from down, further down, that had been, doing the running repairs on a destroyer that had been under fire. We had to renew plates, and we had everything aboard, the same as we had on the Tyne. We had workshops that could even deal with gears. The gear, we had a gear planer that would deal with the gears 10 feet diameter on a destroyer. You know, the big gears from the high speed down to a low speed. The gearbox on a destroyer is the major thing. The turbines are turning over at 30,000 revs, but the propeller is only turning over at something like 50 revs a minute. So you're going through a gearbox. And we even, on the Wayland, had gear planers to produce the chain of gears for a gearbox on a battleship. Very comprehensive workshop facilities.
How do you spell Wayland?
W-A-Y-L-A-N-D, which I believe is the patron saints of blacksmiths. Very intriguing. And then I finally left the Wayland in, 1945, I suppose it would be, and joined the Renown, battlecruiser Renown.
Did the enemy have any capability of attacking Trincomalee when you...
Oh, were yes, there? Yes. Trincomalee Harbour has a very small entrance, but a colossal Anchorage. And Anchorage, the Anchorage of Trincomalee is so colossal that, I mean, you can see from one side to the other, but it's very similar to Scapa Flow. Fairly big waves in the, you know, when the wind blows in the monsoon season. But I've seen three battleships, four aircraft carriers, a couple of squadrons of cruisers, three flotillas of destroyers, all in Trincomalee Harbour, and there was still room for others to get in. But the entrance was so narrow, it was blocked off with netting and a block ship, and we had a what was known as pouncer patrol permanently out there with depth charges to ensure that no Japanese submarine ever got in. And of course then there would be long distance surveillance from the harbour entrance out in the Indian Ocean itself to ensure that any Japanese submarine that was around would have been found. But they were worried about two-man submarines, because when we were in Alexandria we had seen the results of a two-man submarine from the Italians that came into the harbour in Alexandria and actually sank one of our battleships. So that's what we were worried about in Ceylon, that in Trincomalee, which was Sri Lanka now, that a Japanese two-man submarine or a one-man submarine could come in and sink some of our big capital ships.
What exactly did you see at Alex?
At?
Alex.
Oh, just I can't remember which battleship it was, just sitting there on the mud of the harbour.
Did the Japanese actually attack Trincomalee when you were there?
No. We had a Japanese plane came over on one occasion, but that was a very, very isolated incident. I think we were far enough away from the actual fighting area. Japanese tended to have aircraft carriers concentrating on the American forces, not on the British forces. They did not send any of their aircraft carriers towards us at any time. In the just over 12 months I was in Trincomalee, I don't recall any Japanese aircraft coming over at all.
You said you went to Renown?
Yes, I joined the Renown. What was happening was they said all time-expired people from Far Eastern service who've been away from England for more than 2 years will join the Renown, and she will off-ship her people that have only been on for 6 months or so onto all the other ships. And so the fleet was denuded of long-term people, and they concentrated on the Renown, and we steamed her home. The idea was that the Renown was coming home to take the surrender of the German fleet, because by this time Germany was just about defeated. And we came home at very high speed. We made the fastest trip of any ship that has ever come from Colombo to the UK. We did it in, I think it was 10 days 10-14 days. We left Colombo Harbour and we just opened the throttles full bore. We were unescorted. We had no destroyer escort, because the destroyer would not be able to keep up with us. And we did about 32 knots all the way over to Aden. And from Aden, we didn't oil at Aden, if I remember rightly. We came through to Port Tewfik, the other end of the canal, and we oiled there. Then we came through the canal and sped from Port Said, the north of the canal, north end of the canal, all the way to Alexandria, to Gibraltar. We oiled in Gibraltar, and while we were in Gibraltar, we heard of the death of Roosevelt. And we left Gibraltar and sailed for Scapa. And we arrived in Scapa, and we didn't arrive in Scapa, I beg your pardon, we came round Scapa through the Pentland Firth and down to Rosyth. And we arrived in Rosyth for, I think it was 2 days before VE Day. And on the day after VE Day, we took the surrender of the German fleet. the admirals, German admirals, about, I don't know, I can't remember the numbers at all, but about four or five admirals came aboard the Renown. The Royal Marines were on deck. I remember I was on top of Y gun watching all this. It's X and Y gun were the guns astern, the large 15-inch guns on the Renown. I was watching, and the Royal Marines did not present arms. They just stood there at attention when the Germans came aboard, and the Germans went down in the war room and offered the complete surrender of the German fleet. Most one of the memories one has of the, you know, the end of hostilities.
Where did this take place?
This took place in Rosyth itself, in the river. What's the river at Rosyth?
The Forth.
The River Forth. Under the Forth Bridge, on the right, on the starboard side. That's right. The Forth Bridge is Rosyth, and just off Rosyth, we were at anchor off Rosyth Naval Base, Rosyth Dockyard.
Had this high-speed voyage done any damage to the engines?
I don't think so. I think she was designed to do that sort of thing, you know, for a fair endurance test, for a fair time, you know. I don't think we did any harm. We certainly, coming off the, I remember quite distinctly, because I was on deck, I was off watch, on deck, seeing a couple of German U-boats on the surface with their white flags up on the conning towers, on the periscopes. They were ordered to come to the surface and stay there until collected. And off the east, west coast of Ireland, we saw two U-boats on the surface, surrendered. Very interesting, very good, yeah, good.
Did you then have to stay in the Navy, or were you then released?
No, I. We left Rosyth and came down to Portsmouth, because that's where Renown was based. And while we were in Portsmouth, I knew that my younger brother was a captain in the Royal Marines, and he was commanding officer of the workshops at Fort Cumberland, which was attached to Eastney Barracks. And so I went down. Well, I can't remember how I first contacted him, but anyhow, I went down there and saw him, and I know he sent me back in a Royal Marine Jeep back, and that was a coming through the dockyard and coming back to the Renown, when a Royal Marine Jeep with a Royal Marine chauffeur stops at a battleship, they think it's nothing less than an admiral, and I was only a chief petty officer, got out, but they thought I was probably a messenger anyhow. But anyhow, my brother and I hadn't seen each other for what, 4 years, I suppose, all of 4 years. And so we, our ways had gone quite in different directions. Although we'd been fairly close, we didn't realise it, fairly close on many occasions. Certainly in the invasion of Sicily, he was involved in Royal Marine transport, and I was only just across the water in North Africa. But in meeting him again, he said, you'd like to come down to the mess for dinner one night. So I said, well, how do I come? He said, that's all right, I've got a civilian suit in my room, you can change into that. So I changed into a civilian suit with my Royal Navy tie, and I was invited into the Royal Marines mess for dinner. And while I was there, I met an engineer captain, Jimmy Green, and in the anteroom beforehand, having drinks, and we were talking of this, that, and the other. And he said, you've had a fairly extensive, I think his word was, experience during your last 4 years, 4 or 5 years. I think you deserve a quiet number from now on. I said, well, I'd love one, but I can't see what I'm going to do. I shall be remustered down to Chatham Barracks and probably get another destroyer or something. So he said, I think I'll see what I can do. And the next thing I knew was I was sent back from renowned with a whole gang of us to Chatham Barracks by special train, and we arrived in Chatham Barracks, and I'd only been there, oh, I suppose, less than a week. I think I had some leave first, and then I came back, and I was in the chief of the RA's mess, chief petty officer's mess, and I was sent for by the drafting commander. And I went down to the drafting commander's office, and he said, we've met before, haven't we? And I said, Commander, it wasn't Tyrwhitt Betteridge, it was another one, Twinborough. Quiet, Commander Twinborough, yes, sir, we have. I met you about 5 years ago. So he said, yes. He said, well, I've had a message from a friend of mine who says that I must see you get a quiet number. So I'm attaching you to the Engineer Admiral staff in the dockyard. And so I joined the Engineer Admiral staff at the dockyard, Engineer Admiral Sidney Frew, and I was one of four either chief ERAs or acting chief ERAs who did acceptance trials. And I then got a cabin in Navy House, a living out allowance, a travelling allowance, railway warrants. I got the full treatment, and I travelled all over dockyards in the northeast of England and in Scotland, accepting Navy generators, compressors and what have you. As I mentioned, I was responsible for, when I was on HMS Tyne, and I said that there were people, personnel, at the workshops of these various suppliers, ensuring that the generators and what have you were of a very, very high standard. And I remember going to one particular generator manufacturer. I've got an idea, it was W.H. Allen at Bedford, and watching a generator, a steam generator, supplied with steam from a Navy-type boiler, run up to full speed, and it was on a platform that simulated the roll, pitch and yaw that I mentioned to you before, to ensure that that generator would supply electricity when it was at an angle of, oh, I don't know, 70 degrees from vertical in both directions, and then tipped. So that generator did its roll, pitch and yaw all the time. It was at full generation, and that there was no variation in the supply. And I had to watch that for an hour before I signed the docket to say that it was suitable for sending to the ship where it would have been fitted. I had a very, very interesting last seven months, I suppose, in the Navy. Meeting admirals and almost getting on Christian name terms with them. It was quite amazing. On an admiral staff, you know. It's a very, very close community that, I don't know, it was quite amazing.
How did the admirals treat you?
Well, I always remember on one particular night, I was the duty chief, and I was supposed to work the telephone exchange, and a telephone call came through from the flag officer. I've never forgotten it. Flag officer Dover. And he asked to speak. I want to speak to Admiral Frew, Rear Admiral Frew. And I said, hold the line just a moment, sir. And I suddenly realised I didn't know which plugs and things to pull in. So there was nothing else for it. I had to go into Admiral Frew's office, knock on his door, come in. Oh, I'm sorry to trouble you, sir, but there's a telephone call from Flag Officer Dover, and I don't know how to work the telephone exchange. And so he came into the exchange, sat down at the telephone exchange, and took the call from there. But it was that sort of situation, not a case of you're about to be court-martialed because you don't know how to do your job. We all, in a sense, mucked in together. It was very, very intriguing. Very intriguing indeed.
You had that experience in the battleship or battle cruiser. How did you like life in a battle cruiser as compared with a
battle? Oh, it was very remote. That's the only thing I can say. When you have served on a destroyer, which had only got five ERAs on it, in a very small mess, something like 12 feet square, I suppose, about the size of this room, and you live and sleep and breathe in this room, and then you go onto a battleship.